Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Dennis McKenna. But before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. First, you can, of course, always get new regular episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Click the link in the description and check us out on Rockfin. You get all our premium content, our regular shows, and all the awesome content from every creator on Rockfin. Check out the new podcasts on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. There's a lot, and we have more to come. Inception, Raised by Giants, Day Zero, Understanding Propaganda. You can get them all in one place, our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. And finally, guys, I talk about it almost every show. You know, C60 Purple Power, maybe the most powerful antioxidant known to man, has helped me with sleep, energy, well-being, inflammation, energy, so much more. You can get C60 for your pets. Your pets can feel amazing, too. Click the link in the description. You get 10% off your order, plus free shipping. Go check them out. See what they have to offer. Today, I want to welcome Dennis McKenna. He has conducted research in ethnopharmacology for over 40 years. He is a founding board member of the Hefter Research Institute and was a key investigator on the Ayahuasca Project, the first biomedical investigation of ayahuasca. He is the younger brother of Terrence McKenna. Since 2019, he has been working with colleagues to manifest a long-term dream, the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, a nonprofit organization founded in the spirit of ancient mystery schools and dedicated to the study of plant medicines, consciousness, intelligence in nature, preservation of indigenous knowledge, and a revisioning of humanity's relationship with nature. Dr. McKenna is author or co-author of 6 books and over 50 scientific papers in peer-reviewed journals. Dr. McKenna, welcome. How are you doing today?
Pretty well. Getting toward the end of the week. Rainy day here in Abbotsford, so a good day to just chill out in the basement, which is what I usually do anyway.
Hey, it's kind of rainy day here too and a little cold, so I feel that it's a good day to hang out inside. And it's great to have you on. I'm honored. I've been looking forward to this. You know, I've experienced firsthand the amazing benefits of psilocybin, and it was a major contributor to my current situation and getting me headed in the right direction, not only with this current career, living my passion, but getting rid of the fear that it took to get me to this place. You know, I was living in a lot of fear based on quitting a job that I wasn't enjoying, that it wasn't making me happy, and kind of pursuing this as my passion. And that kind of helped me break free of that, you know, using psilocybin, microdosing, and things of that nature. I'd like to know when and how, of course, you got involved with this amazing research in plant medicine. You know, we all know, of course, your brother Terrence was a pioneer working with this, and I'd like to know what got you involved.
Well, I think you just said it. You know, my brother Terrence, being 4 years older, I mean, I suppose eventually, you know, even if I hadn't had a brother, I would have stumbled on this myself, you know, but being 4 years older, he was pushing the envelope on a number of fronts, you know, about, you know, before I was. I mean, he was going to school in California while I was still in high school, stuck back in this Colorado town, you know, that we grew up in. We had mutual interests in what you might call all things weird. I mean, we were kind of nerdy. Both of us really kind of science geeks when we were teenagers in different ways. But, you know, so you kindly characterize it as research. And maybe it evolved into that. I would say when we started out, we didn't think of it as research. We thought of it as, you know, getting high. Right. And, you know, just experimenting with psychedelics in the late 60s, where everybody else was interested in it. You know, I think for us, the thing that made a difference here that changed our focus from casual and curiosity to actually dedicating our lives to this thing was our experiences with DMT. And DMT was not around much in the 60s. Now it's quite easy to find, they tell me. But DMT was a kind of a mysterious psychedelic at that time. You didn't see it much. It was hard to get. When you got it, it was, you know, not a good synthesis. Not that it mattered, because you smoked it, it still did the trick. But DMT was fascinating for us because it was so, it seemed in a class by itself in terms of the levels of strangeness, the sort of portals to other dimensions that it could open up. You know, and for comparison, in the 60s, we had LSD. That's what there was. And occasionally you get mescaline or peyote, but generally the psychedelic of the era was LSD. And nothing wrong with LSD. LSD is also a fascinating psychedelic, but it does not put you into these apparent extra-dimensional places that DMT does. So we were just fascinated by that. And our interest in this really didn't come. We were not what I'd call spiritual seekers. We were novelty seekers. You know, we were interested in extraordinary experiences, whether they had a spiritual foundation or not. That was less important to us. Well, you know, if you've had experience with DMT, you know that it ticks the box, shall we say, as an extraordinary experience. And really for us, one of the most extraordinary experiences we'd ever had. And 50 years later, I have to still say it's still right up there, you know, as one of the more interesting, fascinating psychedelics. Not that I take it much anymore, but you know, the memory resonates, and occasionally I do. But the memory resonates. Like a lot of psychedelic experiences, they're significant events in your life, you know, and you remember your important psychedelic trips. I mean, I know I certainly do, and I've had hundreds. And I don't remember hundreds. I remember the ones that stand out, you know, like anything else. So that's kind of what got us down the primrose path on the road to psychedelics. We just felt that this was worth looking into. And so it has proven to be.
Right. Now, I have yet myself to try DMT, but I have tried LSD, mescaline, and psilocybin. And I started out, like many, with LSD, like you said, you know, as kind of like to get high, as a little party thing as a teenager and in my 20s. And it wasn't until I really tried psilocybin that I had more of a spiritual experience with this. The LSD mm-hmm. was kind of like more of a party thing. It got me up and, you know, a little hyped and maybe see a few colors and cool things here and there, but I didn't really have this deeper kind of connective experience to the universe and everything until I tried psilocybin. Do you find that common with many people?
You mean the difference between LSD and psilocybin?
Yes.
Well, of course, LSD is a dose thing. You know, don't underestimate LSD. The doses that are around these days, as I understand, are fairly low. They're about 100 micrograms, you know, which is, I mean, you can feel the effect, but this is not going to knock you off your pedestal necessarily.
Right.
Back in the day when you were not born, and, you know,
yeah,
before the earth's crust curled, I suppose you know, I mean, we had orange sunshine and white lightning and that kind of stuff. So that was like 500 micrograms, that kind of thing. And that was a significant dose. And you could get to some really interesting places. But there's there's a character to the psilocybin experience, and it seems much more alive, much more natural, which it is, of course. And just, you know, sometimes I talk about the tryptamine dimension, you know, it seems to put you into this place that all of the tryptamines do, more or less. It's the same place. Mushrooms, because psilocybin, of course, is a close relative of DMT chemically. And so you've got DMT and psilocybin, bufotenine, 5-methoxy-DMT. They're all part of this chemical family of tryptamines. Now, technically, LSD is also a tryptamine, but it's a little more complex than these things. And all of these things hit the same receptors in the brain pretty much and, you know, have similar effects. So so the tryptamines are, you know, I think the most interesting, to me, the most interesting class of psychedelics, because they do reliably trigger these mystical experiences or these senses, the experience of being at one with the universe and all of these things that we now know characterize mystical experiences, and that many people have experienced with the help of psychedelics. I mean, if one thing we've learned about this is you don't have to be a saint to have a mystical experience. You don't have to meditate in a cave all your life. You just have to take the right substance at the right dose and the right circumstances. And, you know, a mystical experience can be yours too, you know, to enjoy or to integrate whatever. So, you know, it's interesting that there is some built into everybody's brain, apparently, is the neural architecture to have these kinds of experiences.
And almost everyone that I know that has had a real strong psychedelic experience has admitted that it has changed at least some aspect of their lives profoundly after they've had this experience compared to before. Mm-hmm. Is this also something you find pretty much across the board?
Yeah, yes, I do. I mean, they are, they are very impactful. And you're probably familiar with Roland Griffith's work, his group at Johns Hopkins, and with psilocybin primarily. And they were the first ones to really do a rigorous kind of scientific investigation of psilocybin as a mystical experience, you know. And their conclusions from that was that, you know, out of their study cohort, they had, you know, about 30% of the people said it was the most significant experience, personally meaningful experience was the phrase they used, of their entire lives, you know. And another big chunk of that sample said, well, it was among the top five for sure, you know. So, you know, a substance that can reliably induce meaningful experiences, personally meaningful experiences, has got to be good for something. And it basically is something that people come away from that with and say it was the most profound, most meaningful experience of my entire life. So it's not surprising if people change in response to that, you know. I mean, if it wasn't really impactful, and I suppose for some people, it's not, you know. I mean, it's just another experience, and, you know, you have it and don't think about it too much. But other people integrate it better, you know, and they are really impressed and changed by it, and usually in very positive ways, you know. I think that's its therapeutic use, is that the effects, you know, this it changes your perspective, basically. And it lets you step out of your ordinary reference frame and look at things from a little different, through a different lens temporarily. And it's a useful lens. And sometimes you wonder, you know, it's like before you were staring through a smudge lens, you know, getting, I think in ordinary reality, it's kind of a distortion of reality in some ways. And psychedelics can be like psychic Windex, you know, they let you clear the lens and see things more clearly.
There we go. I'm sorry, I was muted. Yeah, it's exactly, if I have a good experience or profound experience, it's like I've had a great therapy session. It's like having a little therapist in my head for a few hours, and the best one I've ever had, you know, they could get down to the root and tell you where you're screwing up and really point out what's going on. And even the worst, like, you know, some of the worst trips or experiences I've had where it could get scary, at the end I come out and I'm like, I'm glad that happened, because I learned something from that. I learned something about myself and, you know, the experience and everything. So yeah, it's like a therapy session going on. It's great. And I want to talk about what is actually going on in the brain, because isn't there been studies where, you know, under the influence, the brain displays less activity when being monitored?
Yes, there is, and it's complicated, you know, like everything about neuroscience, it's complicated. But under some conditions, it's not so much that it generates less activity, but there's less connectivity between different parts of the brain. It seems like, the brain, like almost all biological systems, is based on feedback loops and homeostasis and all that. And, you know, we're genetically and evolutionarily and personally programmed to kind of maintain an even keel, if you will. And that's useful. That's what they call the default mode network these days in neuroscience. It's basically a set of behaviors that you enact for ordinary states of consciousness, just to get through every day. You know, you have to stay focused and pretty much on what's happening, pay attention and so on, so you don't, you know, walk into walls or step in front of buses or things like that. You know, that's not convenient. But the default mode network also is designed, well, it's not designed, it's not like anyone designed this thing, just the way it works is it shields you from a lot of, it keeps you in an ordinary, more or less an ordinary state of reality. And that's where we are most of the time, you know, but sometimes it's useful to step away from that, to step outside that reference frame. And that can help you have insights about yourself, about the nature of reality, about your relationship to reality, just things that are normally filtered out. You know, the brain is very good at filtering things out. That's at least half its function, is not to let information in, but actually block information so that you can make sense of the input that you do get. Otherwise, you'd just be overwhelming, you know. But once in a while, under the right circumstances, and this is the important thing about taking psychedelics, you have to pay a lot of attention to set and setting. You want to do it in a place that's appropriate and where, you know, you're not in danger. You're not in danger of disrupting other people. And basically, you're in a situation where you can just surrender to the experiences, knowing that you've taken all the steps you can to make sure that, you know, you have created a safe set and setting to have it. And so that's why they emphasize set and setting so much, because, you know, it is disrupting. That's the whole point. So if you do that, then, and do it in a way where you can just surrender to it and let it happen. You know, you alluded before, I don't think there is such a thing as a bad trip, you know, in general, because you can learn from all of these trips, you know, and they can be scary. They can be scary, but that's where, you know, planning the circumstances, the setting comes in, so that you take all steps to know, and also where courage sets in. You know, there's a certain point. I mean, they can be scary, but you have to find the courage to just let go, just surrender to it, because the chances are, when these things come up that are disturbing, there's a reason for it. And essentially, you're being offered a chance to confront that, learn from that, and if you're in a ideal set and setting, then it's much easier to do that. Not that it isn't still scary, but a little less so, because you don't have to worry about real world issues, you know. And so that's what they say, you know. And sometimes in ayahuasca, but a lot of my experience has been with ayahuasca, but I've heard shamans say, well, you know, if you're confronted with the anaconda who comes to eat you, you know, you just jump in. You don't run away. You run toward it. Because these entities are fearsome, but basically benevolent in some way.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff. I want to talk about, you mentioned these entities. I want to talk about the contact experiences that are possible with psychedelics. Now, before I've even had any contact experiences using psychedelics, I had a contact experience through meditation. It was a very spiritual experience. I believe it was possibly a spirit guide of some sort that I was speaking with. But it happened again after I started using psilocybin a little bit. After I had that experience, I was able to kind of recreate and speak again with this entity much easier this time after taking the psilocybin. And it happened a few times after that with, you know, different types of entities, I think. It's very interesting. It wasn't me that I was talking to myself. I could very much tell a difference in an overwhelming feeling of, like, love and these amazing aspects to it that, you know, aren't part of a normal trip, you could say. You know, what do you think is really happening here? Are we accessing something outside ourselves or is this a part of ourselves that we're speaking with? What do you think?
I think nobody knows. I think there are all kinds of you know, speculations. So let me ask you, these the entities that you contacted, it's not always the same entity, right?
It was two or three different types of entities over a few experiences. All benevolent, very loving.
Always loving. Well, that's good.
Yes.
Sometimes always benevolent.
But I got lucky. All of these were very loving, very benevolent. They kind of sent these emitting feelings of love that I've never felt before. It was like a drug on top of a drug on top of it. It was really amazing, you know. And the communication was psychic, instantaneous, just spectacular.
So you encountered different entities, but were there instances when you went back to an entity that you encountered before? I mean, did these things go through, like, cycles?
I was able to, speak with them at different times, and they came back, yes.
Yeah, so you have the impression that somewhere out there, whatever we mean by that,
there's
like a pantheon of entities that you can connect to on a more or less reliable basis, and you know, I mean, actually to the same entities at different times.
See, I don't know. That's my whole question. I have no idea what I'm speaking with. I have only speculations and theories, but, you know, based on conversations I've had, you know, it could be. I don't know. That's why I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
Well, my thoughts are as muddled as anybody's, probably. I mean, people do have these encounters, apparent encounters. But beyond that, what can you say about it? I mean, you can't even say, well, they're out there. Well, what do you mean by out there? You know, out where? You know, and when you think about, you know, what are the things, something that psychedelics make you realize is, there is these boundaries, these distinctions between in there and out there are not really real. And, you know, we have the realization that we're all one, we're all connected, and all of that. So this idea of out there, in there, I'm here, and these entities are out there. This is all part of this artificial reality that we construct for ourselves to make sense out of it. Do the entities exist outside your mind? Are you really tapping into some other dimension, we'll call it provisionally, or is this an aspect of yourself that is revealing itself to you as though it were not yourself?
Yes, exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly.
That's the big question. And it's very hard to know. It's very hard to know. How would you determine that? How would you be able to test that? You know, my brother, struggled with this when he used to take psilocybin, pretty high doses, by himself usually, and then he would get into these dialogue situations with whatever these entities were, and mm-hmm. and he would say exactly this: how do I know that you're real? How prove to me that you're real, you know? And he said, if you can tell me something that I can't possibly know, then I will be convinced that you're real, you know. But you can see the tautology and the problems with that approach, because and the entities would say, well, if we do that, then you won't need us anymore. so we're not going to tell you something that you can't possibly know, but you know, the paradox is, how would he know what he couldn't possibly know without already knowing? I don't know. I think there is this tendency, especially people in ceremonial situations and so on, to project onto the medicine, you know, and to anthropomorphize the medicine and say, you know, and like people talk about Mother Ayahuasca all the time, that sort of metaphor. I think it's okay, but it's important, you know, to realize this is probably a metaphor, you know. And when you take something like ayahuasca, because it's so immersed in other cultures, traditions, and so on, so there's a tendency to adopt that perspective, you know, but we're not indigenous in the same way they are. Their view of it may be very different. If entities are out there, it would be interesting to know that. But I think more importantly is, whatever channel these insights come from, whether they come from outside entities or whether they come from some part of yourself that appears to be another entity, the question is, what is the information good? You know, are you getting a message that makes sense, that you can integrate, that you can benefit from some way? Is it, in other words, a valid learning experience? You know, and if it is that, then you can accept it, and you don't really have to, you know, whether it's some other entity or some part of yourself, doesn't really matter. We'd like to know, but it doesn't really matter in terms of the insights you're getting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I tend to kind of lean towards, probably is an aspect of myself, but still don't know. And it's very interesting to kind of explore that. Before we move on from entities, I want to get your thoughts on the machine elves that are reported through DMT experiences many times. You think this is kind of along the same lines? Because I've heard some pretty creepy experiences with these things.
Well, yeah. I think it's the same kind of thing. You know, this perception of external entities and it also is, I mean, it's caused the symptom of reading too much Terence McKenna, you know. I mean, he's the machine elf guy. I never saw machine elves. I don't get machine elves.
Right. Yeah, I've talked to many who have, and some who have, so, you know. It's strange.
Yeah, but their minds have all been poisoned by Terrence McKenna. I mean, you have to be careful, you know, because we do tend to acquire these memes. And in part, I think that's because, you know, almost by definition, you know, these experiences can't really be described very well. So, you know, in language, they're really metalinguistic or supralinguistic kind of, you know, experiences. They're by definition ineffable, inexpressible. But we're linguistic species, and of course, you know, we try to grasp any kind of linguistic box that we can stuff these things into. Otherwise, they're really scary, you know, because we can't. So there's a tendency to try to wrap language around this in some ways. The language is inadequate, really, but it's almost irresistible to try to do that, just as a way of explaining it to yourself. So, that's just the way we are. We're going to try to find metaphors that fit the experience, and that's fine. I mean, that's part of integrating it, you know. But you sort of have to remember, I'm sure you've had this experience yourself with your own experiences, you know, the memories and the construction you take back with it, the recollection you take back, it's, you know, it's about as close to, you know, the actual experience as a portrait of somebody is to the actual person. You know, it's basically a map or it's a schematic. It's not, so it's flat, it's two-dimensional, it lacks that, you know, that full dimensionality that it has when you're experiencing it, you know. I mean, when you're actually in the throes of it being experienced, the language, you know, impulses to box everything into language is temporarily suspended. You know, and you could just have the direct experience. And then later you have to spend time sorting it out. And that's where integration comes in, but it also is where you defuse, I guess you could say, you know, the power of the experience by putting it into an explanatory framework, you know. And it's okay to do that. That's just what we do. We always try to explain to ourselves. It's just important to remember that this is, you know, a pale reflection of what actually happened.
Right. Yeah, I understand. Now, earlier we're talking about LSD. I want to talk about some of the strange and profound experiences, I guess, that I've had. Maybe you can address what could possibly be behind or going on there. As a teenager and in my early 20s, like I said, I experimented with LSD. And you mentioned that it's probably lower doses. Yes, but me and my friends probably took a lot of the lower dose. So it ended up being a higher dose a lot of times. Right. So we've had some pretty profound experiences, including group hallucinations where all of us saw our friends has big Mickey Mouse hands at the same time, like about five or six of us. Things like we somehow thought about something moving on a table and it moved. I was able mm-hmm. to do a bunch of front flips in a row, and I've never done that in my life before and never have since. I mean, just strange mm-hmm. things that I can't really explain that happened to happen when a group of us would get together and do this stuff. Any thoughts on that?
Well, not really, except that it does go on. You know, these kinds of group experiences and these shared hallucinations, if that's what they are. I mean, this is not uncommon. This happens, for example, a lot with ayahuasca and probably with mushrooms as well. And so it's like these group you know, these group sessions where everybody's tuned in more or less to the same wavelength. And maybe there is some kind of a resonant field set up or some kind of a, you know, some kind of a, I mean, that's one way to think of it, where everybody is getting the same meme and seeing the same things, that, you know, essentially telepathy or some version of that. And I guess it's, I mean, it's interesting that this goes on. Very hard to study, though, because you, you know, it tends to happen spontaneously. You can't really plan for it. And then when it does happen, I mean, if you wanted to study it, I'm not sure how you would set it up, but you could think about, you know, trying to, again, like my brother's exercise with asking it to tell him something he couldn't possibly know. But, you know, I mean, these things do take place. I do not know, you know, there's no substitute for experience. That's the thing. You have the experience, and to determine if everyone was having that same experience, well, you can compare notes, you know, and yes, it would appear so. What explains that? On if is there a scientific explanation? You could say, well, you know, we're programming each other's pheromones. We've set up a pheromonal, you know, environment here that we're all experiencing the same things more or less, or whatever. But these are all explanations after the fact, you know, and they don't have the immediacy that having the experience does.
Yeah, it's fascinating, though, and especially, you know, to have that experience firsthand and, you know, to be able to be a part of that. It changes you in many ways. I want to talk about the ancients and the possibility that psilocybin or psychedelics or any type of these plant medicines could have been maybe responsible for some of the scriptures and writings we have about the spiritual experiences that some of the characters in the Bible and, you know, ancient texts predating the Bible, Sumerian texts and beyond, Egyptian, could have been because they were having psychedelic experiences and having these type of, you know, contact experiences like we were just talking about.
Right. Yes. Well, now, you know, these use of the psychedelics in spiritual traditions like Dionysus, Eleusis, and Christianity, and you know, medieval witchcraft and all that. All of this is becoming like a cottage industry in terms of writing about it. You know, all kinds of people are writing about this. Now it's, you know, the original, I mean, the origins of all this was the book, The Road to Eleusis, which was written by Carl Ruck, who is a classic scholar, Albert Hoffman, the chemist that discovered LSD, and R. Gordon Wasson, the mushroom guy. And they came out with this book that speculated that at Eleusis, there was a potion that was drunk. Well, we know this much. Nobody's disputing that. The question, there was a potion called the Kukian that was drunk in this special circumstances in, you know, darkened room, and people had revelations and amazing experiences that we're not supposed to talk about. It was supposed to be a big secret. That's one of those kind of secrets that wasn't really a secret, you know, but it was something that people, you know, made a pilgrimage to Eleusis at some point in their lives to have these experiences. And the books that have been coming out, The Immortality Key by Brian Mararescu, sort of takes up where that left off and postulates that the, you know, the Dionysian and the Eleusinian mystery cults were, you know, using beverages, mainly beers. They were fermenting beer. They were putting all kinds of stuff in there, whatever came to hand. Occasionally, they would put ergot in it. But whereas Ruck and his colleagues in The Road to Eleusis, you know, postulated that it was always ergot. It was prepared from an ergot-containing, ergot-infested barley. That's how they made it. This later data seems to indicate that ergot and many other things were included in these preparations. But, you know, definitely these things were used in even in early Christianity. And when, which was mainly a matriarchal thing in the first 2 centuries AD. And then when the Council of Nicaea was held, I think that was the 4th century AD, they eliminated all that from the official transcripts, basically.
Yeah.
They didn't want to admit to it, but definitely these things were in those traditions, you know. And there's a lot of dispute. I was on a podcast just the other day, just a couple days ago, with a couple of guys that are scholars of psychedelics. They represent themselves that way. A guy named Chris Bennett and Tom Hatzis. They've written many books about the history of psychedelics, and they are not that impressed with Brian's work. You know, have you read The Immortality Key?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, that's his thesis, and these guys have, they disagree with him in some of what he postulates. In part, I think it's because he, in a lot of ways, he ignores their work, and there's nothing that, you know, or often does, so there's nothing that pisses off a scholar as if another scholar has dissed their work or not acknowledged it. But this is just another indication that, you know, these religions, and Brian's work is interesting for a number of reasons, but not least of which it traces in his understanding of it, it traces the origin of these things all the way back to Göbekli Tepe, which is this, you know, civilization in Anatolia, 13,000 years old, and a monumental civilization. And they, as he described it, they were into fermentation. They had fermented beverages, and it was basically a funerary death cult that they were preparing these things, and that those were spiked, you know, with various things, not always what we would think of as psychedelic, sometimes henbane and opium and this sort of thing. And Chris Bennett, has written about the role that cannabis probably played in some of these traditions. So I think I've not pretended to be a scholar, or I haven't looked at it in the depth that they do, but I think the take-home lesson is that these were experimentalists. You know, these people were making beer, and like craft brewers everywhere, they'd put different things in it to see what happened. So they just grabbed whatever was available and say, whoa, what does this do? So you got some pretty gnarly brews out of this. Henbane and opium and hashish and all of this stuff.
Yeah, man, some of those sound pretty good. But yeah, now they had lately, past 10-20 years, we've seen some major advancements in, you know, the medical industry looking at treatments for depression using psychedelics. I see articles coming out every day. So it's encouraging that it's starting to actually be looked at. I've had friends get off of hard drugs using psychedelics and microdosing. So let's talk about this. When did this first start getting realized and recognized that, you know, psychedelics can help with so many things and be so beneficial for mental health?
Well, it took long enough. I mean, the thing is, there was very active research on psychedelics, particularly LSD, in the 50s and the 60s, you know, and it was being taken seriously, particularly for treating alcoholism. There's a hospital here in Canada, a couple of them that were basically hospitals for treating alcoholics, and they were using LSD with great success. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, the guy that did that was Humphrey Osmond, who was actually the person. He was a psychotherapist. He's the person that turned on Aldous Huxley and the person that coined the term psychedelic, actually. He's credited with that. So it's not like there was not a body of research, you know, at least LSD was by far the best researched one. But back in the 50s and 60s, there was active research going on. At the same time, LSD was diffusing into society. It was escaping from the lab, from the clinics into society. And we're seeing things like the, you know, Merry Pranksters and the Human Beings and Timothy Leary and all that. So this was a period of social disruption and change, and the psychedelics were part of that. And there was a backlash. There was a reaction by the authorities, by older people, you know, and it was all about, my God, our kids are getting high on some substance we never heard of. You know, this has to be bad, you know. And so there was a big backlash that, you know, and it was disrupting society. Of course, society needed just that disruption of that time.
Yeah.
Kind of like our society right now, you know, it needs a good slap upside the head to wake up.
Oh, yeah.
But that led to shutting down all the formal research in clinical work with psychedelics, the lab work, the in vitro work, basic neuroscience, that sort of stuff continued, but even that slowed down. So it wasn't really until the early 90s when Rick Strassman, researcher at the University of New Mexico, a psychiatrist there, decided to investigate DMT. And he was, at the time, he was working on melatonin, and he was working on the role of melatonin, which is a pineal hormone, right, in regulating circadian rhythms and this sort of thing. And he got interested in DMT from that perspective. And he applied to the FDA to do a dose escalation study with DMT. And that's really, that marks the point when the door to human research began to open up a little bit. One of the things, I think, one of the reasons that he was able to get that study going is that he was not pointing to any kind of therapeutic use at the time. For him, it was a direct observational study, mechanistic study, give these people, these subjects, increasing doses of DMT and pay attention to their stories, you know. And that's really all he was doing. He was not postulating a therapeutic use. He was interested in mechanisms. So that work was done. And then it didn't really open up to research until about 2006, when Roland Griffith's group published the first paper on psilocybin as a mystical experience. And that was really the point at which the research began to expand and build on itself and so on. Rick's study stood out because it was early and people were, you know, I mean, the results were very interesting. In a lot of ways, the results were hard to make sense out of, even for Rick, you know, because he found that at these higher doses, intravenously, high doses, people were getting these near-death experiences, alien abduction experiences, all this crazy stuff, you know, that can happen on DMT. And Rick was sort of, you know, Rick is kind of a, you know, he's basically a clinician in a sense, and he was coming at it from that angle. how do you write your report to NIH, you know, that your subjects are having alien abduction experiences? That's not going to get you the next grant. Not what they're out of here.
Right. Exactly.
You know, he finally reached a point where he just said, well, that's what they're reporting. I don't know. But, yeah. You know, he discontinued his research and sent his DMT back to NIH because he said, I can't make sense out of it. But Roland, of course, had a whole team of clinicians, and they were able to run these very well-controlled studies on psilocybin, and that's really what started it, you know, and then it just grew from there as people, you know, identified different conditions that it could address. And, you know, the spectrum is very broad. I guess if there were such a thing as a, you know, broad spectrum mental health medicine, psilocybin would be it, you know. And the same way we have broad spectrum antibiotics, this is like a broad spectrum medicine for everything from trauma to addiction to depression to, you know, well, those are probably the main things. But that's 90% there of what people suffer from. And usually these things are, you know, they often go together. So it's good that these things are being recognized, you know, because a lot of, you know, the regular psychopharmaceuticals, especially pretty much that we rely on the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the SSRIs, and they don't really, in most cases, solve the problem. They just sort of band-aid it over. And, you know, psychedelics hold out the possibility that you can get to the root of these things and actually get cured, you know, and that's why they're so promising.
Yeah, and we probably wouldn't recommend people doing high doses. This is usually microdosing that's helping people with these, you know, depressive problems. You know, what would you recommend for people who are interested in maybe looking into this, you know, as like a microdosing schedule or something like that?
Well, there's lots of information about microdosing out there. The microdosing guru to all this is a guy named Jim Fadiman, and he's written books about microdosing. Paul Stamets has some information on his website about microdosing. I'm not sure I'm convinced about microdosing myself. I think it may be a placebo effect in a certain way. And that's okay. Placebo effects are real for sure. They do have an effect. But the problem with microdosing is there hasn't been a very rigorous study, you know, a well-designed clinical study that shows there is actually an effect. There was one done somewhat recently in which the it was shown that the microdosing had a beneficial effect, I think on cognition is what it was, but then the placebo also had a comparable effect. So these things are hard to sort out in an experimental study design, you know.
Yeah.
People may, I mean, I feel like if people feel like you know, microdosing LSD or microdosing mushrooms, if they feel like there's a benefit, then I don't see the harm in it, but I think they may be kidding themselves. But, you know, doesn't matter because you're not taking huge doses of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for me personally, I never really got any benefit from microdosing personally. It came from taking a little bit higher doses. But, you know, like you said, it makes sense. You know, higher doses have helped me a lot.
Yeah, and higher doses do. I think the danger of, like microdosing is that in some ways, it's an excuse never to look around the corner and see what's really there. You know, people like to microdose and that's comfortable and they don't have much of an effect. But at some point, it's important to get the full effect, you know, and you'll be surprised, you know, of what's there to discover. So I think there is that. It discourages, you know, it's a temptation to just stay at that low level and never really experience the full spectrum of effects that these things can bring about. And then I would say there is concern with respect to people are microdosing basically with either psilocybin or LSD. Those are the two main ones. And there's some concern about microdosing with LSD because of the this problem known as valvular hypertrophy. It's a growth in the valve tissues in the heart that is caused by serotonin agonist. There's a particular serotonin subtype of serotonin receptors, the 5-HT2B receptors. And LSD hits those. Most of these psychedelics hit those, and it can lead to this problem. When you do it chronically, when you do it once in a while, it's not a problem. But when you do like microdosing is, you know, two or three times a week anyway. So constantly hitting that receptor may lead to this proliferation of valvular tissue, which is not reversible, you know, so it's somewhat scary. The only remedy is a valve replacement. Okay. Now, you know, having said that, I don't want to alarm people, you know, but they should be aware of this. And maybe if they want a microdose, I recommend psilocybin is a better thing to microdose with, because it's the mechanism seems to be that LSD binds to the receptor in a unique way, so that the pocket that it gets into in the receptor folds over it, and it's hard for it to dissociate. So it's constantly stimulating that receptor, and that seems to be what is connected to this valvular hypertrophy. There were a couple of drugs back in the late 90s, early 2000s that were taken off the market because of this effect. One of them was called Fen-Phen, and I think it was being given for anxiety, or I'm not sure what, but it was actually taken off the market because of this effect. So, you know, probably Jim Fadiman's website talks about this. You can find literature about it. If you look at the blog on the Hefter website, there's a reference to this, and I should mention Hefter anyway, if you haven't already.
In your bio, I did, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay, people can look at the Hefter website, and in the blog, there's a discussion of this this issue with microdosing.
To close out on today, I want to talk about the McKenna Academy, what you're doing there, and the Biognosis film that you're working on.
Okay. Well, yeah, so the McKenna Academy is this nonprofit I founded a couple of years ago with some colleagues, and basically, as you can tell from the name, it's all about education. Originally, when we founded it, the idea was that in part a lot of what we were planning to do was do conferences and retreats probably in South America, which is what we had been doing before. So it was just an extension of what we were doing, but we wanted to formalize it as a nonprofit. And that was our original idea. And then about the time that we got incorporated, COVID hit, and it made it kind of difficult to do any traveling, to do these conferences and so on. You know, Peru was hit as hard as any place with COVID. So we had to pivot and try to create a strong online presence, which I think we've done more or less successfully. We've had various events, podcasts and virtual conferences and that sort of thing. So that is what we're doing right now and trying to position ourselves as an educational resource for learning about plant medicines and that sort of thing. And we've offered courses, and people can look at, again, I can put it in the chat, and it's basically just McKenna.academy. And if people go there, they can look at the events and resources tabs and see what kind of stuff we've been doing. And Biognosis Project is part of this. This is our biggest project right now. And what we're trying to do, the subtitle of Biognosis is, we're trying to bridge ancestral wisdom, ancestral plant knowledge with contemporary plant knowledge. So and our focus is on Amazonian ethnomedicine. So what we're doing now, right now, is we're making a series of documentaries that's going to kind of give a snapshot of the state of traditional medicine as it's being practiced in the Amazon in this sort of post-apocalyptic, post-COVID, post-ayahuasca tourism, post-globalization environments. These indigenous communities are really impacted by a lot of this, but then the traditions survive. They change, and that's what they do. So I don't see these. The traditions are changing. It's not like it was 10 years ago, even, or 20 years ago. But it's worth documenting that. And it's in this particular series, we're trying to initially work with a person down in Peru, in Iquitos, who I've actually worked with him for 40 years. And he is the curator of the herbarium at UNAP and the University Nacional Amazonia Paruana in Iquitos. And he just has tremendous plant knowledge, having lived there all of his life and then actually being trained as a scientist. So he brings both perspectives to it. And so we're trying to document what he knows, because he never writes anything down, right? So we're trying to kind of do our initial documentary about Juan and what he knows and what his environment is, in his role at the university. But then, we're hoping to get funding we have the funding to make that short documentary. Then we're looking for support to make about 6 or 7 more short documentaries, 30 to 45 minutes, that will document different aspects of the contemporary scene down there, of which ayahuasca is very important, but it's not the whole story, So we want to look at different, go down there and look at how is this tradition being practiced now, and especially under the impact of global warming and cultural disruption and all of these disruptive influences. So I think it's going to be a pretty interesting documentary series. We're hoping that working with a great production house in New Brunswick named Hemmings House, and they have done films for Netflix and National Geographic and Discovery Channel and so on. So we're hoping that they can, we can put together a teaser reel essentially, and they will pick this up and fund this series. That said, though, if any of your fans, your constituents want to support the McKenna Academy, we welcome that. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit, so we can even give tax deductions if you live in the States. And, you know, we're, you can read about our plans on the website, what we've got in the pipeline and so on. So, yeah, we'd like you to take a look at it. And also, even if you don't donate, just enjoy the content there. There's quite a lot of stuff out there. You know, we did a early in April. April was the actually March, I guess. March this year was the 50th anniversary of the experiment at La Churrera, which is kind of infamous. So we did an event around that. And we've done a number of events, you know, and podcasts and so on. So, you know, this is what we do given the constraints of the time, you know, and we'd like to do in-person conferences, and maybe we can get to that later this, you know, early next year. I mean, nobody knows. COVID keeps everybody guessing.
Yeah. But looking forward to it. You've done fantastic work. Looking forward to the film. And I will put all those links in the description so the audience can go directly and check that out. Dr. McKenna, okay. Thank you so much for coming on. Fantastic information. And I'd love to have you back on sometime in the future.
I'd love to come on. Absolutely.
Great.
We won't make a date, but we'll encounter downstream and we'll do it again.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much again. Fantastic information. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Okay. All right.